We need the whole counsel of God. It's word and deed together. It will always be. And anyone who says anything else is actually not taking on board the whole counsel of God.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Emma Fowle. The Profile is a show where we sit down with a well-known Christian to hear more about their life, their faith and their ministry. It's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. The monthly title features more interviews just like this one, as well as all of the latest news, reviews, columnists and much, much more. Plus, there's great new digital content uploaded daily to our website, premierchristianity.com. To get full access wherever you are in the world, there are print and digital subscription options to suit you. Get the magazine delivered directly to your door or access all of the latest content via your computer, your smartphone or the Premier Christianity app. Head over to premierchristianity.com/subscribe for more information. On today's show, I'm speaking to Bishop Mike Royal. As well as praying for King Charles at his coronation, Mike Royal is the General Secretary of Churches Together in England. A founding trustee of educational charity Transforming Lives for Good, Mike has also been a minister, a street pastor, the joint CEO of Cinema Network, and a mental health chaplain, amongst many other leadership positions and accolades. In our time together today, we'll be chatting about his story, his passion for young people and church unity, and how the church can combat celebrity culture. So, Mike, could you start just by telling us a little bit about your early life? What was home life like for you? Have you always lived in a Christian home? Did you find Jesus at a particular point in your life?
I was born in a Christian home. My parents were first generation Windrush. They came to the United Kingdom in 1957 and 58. They powerfully met Jesus kind of around about 1960, which is roughly the time when they got married as well. And so by the time I came along, they were quite mature in their Christian faith. And so I've never known a life other than being committed to going to church. So that's a little bit about my own background.
Cool. And what was that like for you growing up? What style of church did you go to?
Yeah, so we went to a sort of a classic Pentecostal church, the Apostolic Church UK, which is quite similar to an Elim or an AOG church. I was brought up in the suburbs of London in Purley. And it was your typical sort of middle class suburban church, if you like. But it was in a region that was quite diverse. And so we also related to some of the churches further in a city, London. And so actually from an experiential point of view, my church experience was really diverse with people from backgrounds from all over the world, but particularly from West Africa, and also the Caribbean, as well as here in the UK.
And was that always a happy church experience for you? Were you one of those kids that just sort of grew up in a Christian home, always loved Jesus? Or was there a time where you sort of remember making a commitment of your own, or perhaps struggling a little bit with the expectations of what you were raised in?
My own personal church life was always a happy one. Very much, you know, I was committed to, you know, our Pentecostal congregation. Once a month, I was part of a scout group movement. So I would go to an Anglican church once a month, where we'd be on parade as Cubs and Scouts. And I think that was my first actual ecumenical experience outside my own tradition. And my wife always says to me, you're a secret Anglican, really. And perhaps some of my love of liturgy and of the Anglican and Roman Catholic and Orthodox traditions was sown kind of in those years. But at a personal level, I actually came to faith at 14 and a half years old, where I just knew my life was going in the wrong direction and that I needed Jesus in my life. And one day at a conference in Wales, I put my hand up, I came forward, I knelt down and gave my life to Jesus. And I still remember that day, 31st of July 1982. So I'm one of those who can put a very specific date. And when I found faith for myself, and wasn't just piggybacking on my parents' faith.
Yeah, and that's a really important part of our journeys, really, isn't it? Especially for kids who are raised in Christian homes. I have the opposite story, but very similar. My parents weren't Christians, but I first went to church with brownies. So similarly to you, just that was my first engagement with church, and I really loved it. And
fantastic.
Begged my parents to take me around regularly, much to their amusement and slight horror, I think, at the time.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful.
And I mean, Mike, looking through your CV, the amount of organisations you've been involved with, the positions you've held, the things you've done, you're like truly, truly just such an experience and ecumenical member of the church, like you say. Tell me a little bit about your journey towards what you're doing now, because you're currently the General Secretary of Churches Together. What does that involve? Because when I read that job title, I'm like, I don't know what a General Secretary does. What do you do at Churches Together?
So General Secretary of Churches Together is the Chief Executive of Churches Together in England. Churches Together in England brings 52 denominations, soon to be 54 actually, denominations together across England to work together in unity. And it is actually the official instrument of the churches for ecumenical working and working together in unity. So our work is all about helping churches to a deeper understanding of each other's traditions, and also encouraging them to work together in unity, particularly for the common good, including things like the Warm Welcome campaign, which we've recently had with the cost of living crisis.
So, I mean, a very visual illustration of that, I have to ask you about this, is the King's coronation that you got to be part of recently. How was that? What was that like? Would you ever have imagined at 14 and a half year old Mike, when he first made a commitment to Jesus, that all those years later you would be heading up this huge organisation that oversees 52 denominations, and that you would be present at a state event like the King's coronation?
No, of course, as a young boy, you never imagine that. And I think as a young boy, to be honest with you, you know, I got easily distracted. I kind of remember reading most of my reports was easily distracted. But I always felt that my parents' aspirations for me were greater than perhaps schools. And you know, my primary school, I would say the aspirations for me were low, but also always when I came home, they were high. I think when I got into secondary school and particularly my final high school, Purley High School for Boys, was a really good school and they set high expectations. But I always came home to a father who was a deputy head teacher, a mother who was a homemaker and really strived for my best. In terms of the coronation, it was a great honour to do the coronation. And when you think in 1953 that the Cardinal Catholic Archbishop would have stood outside of the Abbey, to see in 2023 a coronation happening 70 years later, where you have an array of different church leaders, including Anglican, Catholic, Free Church tradition, Pentecostal, and Orthodox, all represented, all delivering a blessing, as well as the involvement of other faith traditions, then we see how far we've come as a nation over the last seven decades.
And tell me why, as a Christian, you're so passionate about that. Why is it that we need to work together as denominations?
I take really seriously the words of Jesus in John 17, that they all might be one, as I and the Father are one. And I think we should take that statement as seriously as we take the Ten Commandments, the Great Commission, or the Great Commandments. I do think that there is a call for us to take seriously working together. And actually, from my reading of scripture, it is a sign of the church's maturity in being able to work together in unity. The challenge comes, of course, when you are seeking to keep unity, even when there's profound disagreement. But actually, I think that it's a sign of the maturity of the church when it can do that.
Yeah, and obviously at the moment we're in the middle of some really heated debates around that, especially when we're touching on the areas of sexuality and gender and looking at everything that's happening in the Church of England. A lot of people would say, well, it's vitally important actually that we know what we think about a certain doctrine and that we hold on and protect that truth. And then there's other people who would espouse a view that is more, well, we have to continue to hold those relationships. How do we do that when it comes to such tricky issues?
Yeah, I mean, the Church of England, you know, the tendency is for everyone to see that because that gets the immediate attention. But the truth is, most denominations in one way or another are having those conversations. Even our Pentecostal churches last year in August, CTE organised a human sexuality conference where we brought in speakers to address these issues. So right across the spectrum, in various forms, these conversations are happening. What I would say is, I would say a very helpful kind of tool for us is in ecumenism, what we call receptive ecumenism, where is you approach one another in dialogue, but you come with a sense of lack and you come with a desire to learn from one another and to be enriched by one another, not necessarily to change the view or the position that we hold, but for a deeper understanding as we journey together. And I would just encourage church leaders and churches to do that. It's possible to do that and also to hold a firm position in your own mind or in your own tradition. Those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, so really what you're talking about is being, I guess, humble and open enough to be able to sort of say, I don't have all the answers here and I genuinely want to listen to what you want to say.
Yeah, humble and open enough, but mature enough too. You know, mature leaders are able to do that. And so when I see a reticence to do that, then, you know, I have to say, look, we really need to lean into this.
What are the other big challenges, do you think, for the church when it comes to unity at the moment? What are the things that, you know, you guys have been working on or that you've experienced in your own life here in the UK that you're like, kind of, these are the big issues that if we really want to see an outpouring of the Holy Spirit? We've had a lot of talk this year, haven't we, looking at things that have been happening over in Asbury and about people saying these are the things we need to deal with if we want to see God moving again in our society. What are the big issues for you?
I think that the church is never better than when it's working together, particularly around social action and social justice. I think that gives it great credibility in the public square. I've cut my own teeth kind of in that. You know, I spent the first 10, 12 years really of ministry in kind of local church ministry in West Yorkshire and more lately here in the West Midlands. But what I really found was that drove me to beyond the four walls of the church, whether that be with transforming lives for good and working with children and young people excluded from school, leading a street pastors team in Birmingham from 2004 to 2008, listening, helping, caring in the community, or just my previous role with Cinema Network, which is about helping churches with their community engagement. For me, I think that when the church is a visible, positive presence in the community, then I think people are attracted by it. And so if the church is a warm hub and people come to a local congregation and they find a loving community who accepts them, who engages with them, who helps them with their isolation, who gives them that sort of mental health friendship support, then actually people who belong will be drawn to believe as well, at their own pace, in their own time, in an appropriate manner. But that happens. And so I think, you know, social action, social justice, really important.
One of the great things about social action is it is a really practical way for churches of different denominations to work together in a location, isn't it? And I mean, I've seen that happen in my own town with things like the food bank. And that is sometimes an area that churches find it easier to be united around than other areas, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. No, indeed. I think that, you know, most churches can unite around running a food bank. Most churches can, you know, rally around a street pastors team that will draw four or five churches together in a town or in a local community to work together. And I think when the public see that, they see that unity. Actually, Jesus says that unity is a sign that I love the world. And again, going back to John 17. And so I think that's really, really important. And I think if people see that the church loves the world, they will be drawn to it. And of course, when people are drawn into the church, then church renewal is much more likely. And some of the revivals that, you know, we have seen in the past and even in the present, quite often they are in part about being people being drawn to Jesus, whether that's directly through the work of the Holy Spirit or through the outreach activities of that church.
Well, let's get back to education. You mentioned earlier that your dad was a deputy headmaster, which is really interesting because a lot of your career has been spent doing things in and around education. So, and you spoke as well about your own experience of sort of perhaps your parents' expectations for what you could achieve being higher than that from your school. Why do you think that was?
I do think certainly in that kind of first generation of Jamaican people that came to the UK, they had high expectations of themselves and they had high expectations of their families. And they weren't going to let issues of racism stop them achieving sort of what they achieved. And so from a very young age, you know, I can remember my dad and my mum saying to me, Mike, you're going to have to work twice as hard to get to where you want to get to. Because the truth is that we're living in a society where there is prejudice, where there is racism and barriers are put up. And so they didn't just leave us high and dry, but actually supported us to do that. And I think that in there were the seeds, really, for the establishment of TLG as a charity. So I'm one of the founding trustees of TLG, although some of its work started kind of way back in the early 90s. But in the late 90s, when it became a charity, I was involved. And then from 2005 to 2016, I was national director with a specific brief of rolling out alternative education provision for children who didn't have the opportunity or the encouragement sometimes that I had kind of from my own home life. I think it's Victor Hugo who said that those who open a school close a prison. And that is still so true. So many children who are excluded from school, and my church still runs two alternative education centres, they end up being known to the police, being known to social services. And if there isn't an intervention, then they end up in prison or worse, sadly, deceased.
So tell us a little bit about the backstory to that. How did you get involved in that work?
Yeah, it, really interesting. I remember when I was in pastoral ministry, I was National Youth Director with the Apostolic Church UK. And I can remember speaking at a conference. I was guest youth speaker at a conference in Denmark. And I remember one of the Kansas City prophet was a guest speaker kind of one night. And he pointed me out in the congregation. Now, I'm not sure whether he pointed me out because he heard from the Lord or because I was one of the few black faces surrounded by all these sort of blonde hair and blue eye kind of people kind of in Denmark. But once he spoke, I knew absolutely he'd heard from the Lord. And he said, I see thousands of young people, thousands upon thousands. And at that time, probably be about 1996, 97, you know, TLG was just something I connected to because it was, you know, some youth work being run kind of down the road. I never knew that as TLG as a charity in its own right took shape, that actually that would be the fulfillment of that prophecy. But it certainly proved to be. And as I got involved, I think that word more and more became real to me. And there was a realization that the fulfillment of that word would in part come through my involvement with Transforming Lives for Good.
And what is it about working with young people that sort of really grabbed your heart then and spurred you into this work with TLG?
I mean, just if you've lived in inner city areas, and, you know, I've lived, you know, significant parts of my life in London, in Birmingham. I was 10 years in West Yorkshire, kind of in a small town. But even there, we had a thriving young people's work kind of in our church, both to young people in the congregation, but also to young people in the community. If you're in any kind of urban area, then the average age is just pretty young. A statistic some time ago in Birmingham said that 40% of the population is under 25 years old. When you're living in that environment, you will be drawn into young people's work. But for anyone who's worked with young people, you just know that their energy and their vitality for life really draws you in. And as an older person, if you can do anything to facilitate that, then that's a good thing. But where you see young people being denied, you know, basic rights like an education without being excluded from school, then absolutely you want to lean into that. And I wanted to lean into that, particularly as someone who had done well in education because of my own upbringing.
So basically you could see that one of the reasons that you succeeded was because you had a stable home and parents who encouraged you and were interested in education and pushed you. And you could see that lack in other children's lives, and you wanted to kind of help provide that for them too.
Absolutely. You know, my own upbringing is a significant reason why I am who I am and where I am today.
Yeah, and I think reflecting on that, that is something I think that the church does have to offer, doesn't it? Because we often use this picture of the church as a family, of a body of believers, and therefore, quite often when we have people in our community that don't have positive experiences of family, we can, as a Christian community, step into that gap and say, we can fulfill some of those functions for you. This is a safe space. We can encourage you. We can build you up. We can try to provide some of those things in your life. How can, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? You were talking about your urban experience. I live in a really rural area, but I grew up in on the outskirts of London, so I've kind of experienced both. But my reflection would be the problems are no different. In some respects, they're kind of worse because we're rurally isolated. So whereas you know, for some of the kids in London, you can cycle or get the tube to X number of projects that exist within a mile radius of where you live. Where I live down in Cornwall, there's nothing and there's no public transport. And even if the kids do have the get up and go to want to be involved in something, it's 30 miles away in a location they can't possibly get to. So right across the UK, I think we are facing these really difficult problems with our young people. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see us facing today, and how can we help as church?
I had, as I've said earlier, grew up in, you know, the suburbs of London. I've lived kind of in West Yorkshire in a sort of a deindustrialised town, Keighley, and spent time in Birmingham, now live in leafy Solihull. So I've put it in the mix. And I would say that the experiences of children actually in those different areas are more similar than people think.
Too many of us are living in a bubble and not hearing both sides of the world's important stories. It's time for a more rounded perspective. It's time to discover Premier Christianity. Balanced, confident, relevant, faith-filled. Discover fresh biblical perspectives as we bring you wide-ranging stories that impact the church. Discover the go-to source for Christian news. Subscribe at premierchristianity.com. Now only £5 for 3 months.
I think that one of the big issues that a lot of children are facing is just poverty. And that kind of at home, some things that people can really take for granted, other people haven't got. So, for instance, space to do your homework. You know, some of the homes that, you know, our teachers have to visit, you know, children, you know, haven't got space just to put their books down on the table and to do homework because, you know, space in the house is such a premium. And then poverty of aspiration. Many of the parents of these children have had a bad experience of school. And so, you know, really a struggle to be able to kind of guide their children kind of through their education. And to be honest, just need really good support. And we try to provide that. And those are issues in the city areas. As much as there are issues in pockets in rural areas and also pockets in suburban areas. So these are issues that are common right across the board. Perhaps what you get in urban areas is a density of population and therefore a concentration of those issues that then makes it more complex for those particular communities and for the agencies that seek to serve them.
Yeah, I think I'd definitely agree. I don't think from my experience of living in rural areas anyway that you get the same kind of gang issues that I've seen in London. But you do get, you know, we are now seeing the proliferation of county lines and that kind of stuff really digging.
Yeah, and knife issues. I mean, not you know, knifing now is as big a problem in small towns as it is in urban areas. And I think that we just kind of got to be very careful of, in my opinion, of some of the media stereotypes that, for example, will say, well, you know, young people carrying knives is a black issue. It's not just the black issue. That happens in the black community, it happens in the Asian community, it happens in the white community. And you look at some of the stabbings that have happened even in 2023, we can get examples, several examples from each of those communities. And so we just need to recognize this is a public health issue. And until we deal with it as a public health issue and not just a criminal issue, then we will continue to have these incidents that absolutely blight our communities and destroy the lives of families and young people.
Yeah, and I think still, I mean, going back to your theme of unity and ecumenical working, I was having another conversation earlier on this week with a Black church leader who said, basically, we were talking about diversity in the church and how we create healthy, diverse churches. And he said, we need church leaders of all backgrounds, all races, all ethnicities to get stuck into the issues that affect their communities and affect our society equally, and not just ones that they perceive to be their problems. And he was specifically referencing knife crime and said, you know, exactly what you said, that it's often stereotypically assumed that that's an issue that affects the Black community, and therefore for white church leaders is not something we need to sort of get involved in. But actually, these are the type of things that as a church, ecumenically as a whole, that we can really, really stand together and try to make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Do Churches Together do that kind of campaigning? Is that part of your remit? Or
we will certainly work with churches who are majoring on that or focusing on that. So where there is a campaign or where there is some joined up working that is looking at a particular issue, we will certainly get kind of behind that. So a different issue, but for example, just this week, we're doing a little, our racial justice working group is doing a little bit of a collaboration with NCLF, which is the Black Church's sort of political, sort of ecumenical kind of coming together. We're doing some work together on Black adoption, because we know that the adoption needs of Black children are higher than their white counterparts. So yeah, we will get behind what the church does, but we're very much kind of church led kind of around these issues.
Let's talk a little bit about exclusion. You mentioned it earlier that you feel that every child has a right to an education and they shouldn't be excluded. Are there any circumstances where, you know, that it just isn't tenable that a child stays in mainstream education? Let's talk, could you unpack that a little bit for me?
Yeah, so I'm not suggesting that necessarily the best place to educate every child is mainstream. What I'm saying is that every child deserves an education. And most of the time, that will be in mainstream for most children. For some children, they need a smaller setting where there's more one-to-one support, and therefore an alternative education setting or a studio school might be more appropriate. And even sometimes with those children, perhaps a full school day, because of the trauma that perhaps they've been through at home or in life in general, means that actually part of the day they'll be supported from home and part of the day they'll attend school. And so what we need is education that's tailored to the needs of individual children. And from child to child, that will look slightly differently.
And you're currently a school governor, you mentioned to me earlier.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So our church runs two alternative education provision schools, both of which originally were TLG schools. And we have an incredible kind of staff team that are working with children from both urban and suburban kind of West Midlands context. And it's a beautiful thing to see, but also has its challenges, because post-pandemic, definitely children are struggling with their mental health, with isolation, and it had a huge impact on the lives of children. And I think that in the years to come, we will more and more realise the huge impact that the pandemic had. I don't think that has fully unfolded as yet.
Do you think we're going to be witnessing the fallout from that for some time to come?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for decades to come, actually. I think that happened within some children's lives at critical moments in their lives. And its impact will be very long term.
That's a very frightening thought, really, isn't it? Because do you think there's enough thinking being done around that at the moment? Are the people in charge of stuff?
I think that if you're in education and in school, you're very aware of it. I think more broadly, when you look at politicians and decision makers, I think lots of them would just like to kind of put the pandemic kind of behind them and perhaps focus on the economic fallout. But I think that the health and well-being and mental health fallout is huge. And we will be living with that impact for some time.
And, you know, there's alternately a part of you that can sort of quite easily feel overwhelmed by that, isn't there? But there's also a group of people, if you're slightly more optimistic, they'll say, do you know what? This is a really great opportunity for the church, like you've said before, for us to be the hands and feet of Jesus in our community and say, like, we can help. How can we get stuck into those problems? How can we come alongside people?
Yeah, I always reflect on the life and ministry of Teresa of Calcutta, who was surrounded by needs but never allowed herself to be overwhelmed by them. The key thing for me is, you know, what are people experiencing? You know, what is God doing, and how do we play our part and join in with what God's doing so that we can make a difference where we see need. And that, for me, are just questions that we need to keep asking ourselves, and to avoid a messianic complex that, you know, we're here to save the world. Jesus is the saviour of the world. He chooses to use his church as his hands and his feet.
And what is it? What do you think God's doing at the moment? Is there anything that you guys are praying into as a team at the moment?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think certainly I feel God is shaking up what church looks like. I think some of the old models of kind of just, you know, lots of programs, I think there's a big question mark over that, and churches needing to be much more focused on what they do and what they don't do, because I think that volunteers have less time now. Perhaps some people have retired post-pandemic. So I think there's that. I think that there's definitely a shake-up in terms of, you know, what church meeting looks like together. I hear lots of churches saying, well, you know, it's not all about Sunday now. I see some churches saying that actually a house group model is really positive. I see some churches saying, actually, rather than meeting every week, we might meet every other week and meet in homes kind of in between. So I think there's lots of soul searching being done by leaders about how the church stays relevant for the future. And how we work in a sustainable way. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah. Did you guys see a lot of that sort of fallout from COVID? Lots of people talked about pastors being really burnt out. Did you guys see that?
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. Yeah, very much so. You know, some pastors took the opportunity to retire. There was a lot of retirement that took place during and immediately after the pandemic. And of course, you know, some churches, you know, and many churches still have not returned to their pre-COVID numbers. That has impacted their finance. And then, of course, there is a question mark whether they have the resources to keep their own full-time minister. So, yeah, I think, again, we're still grappling kind of with some of that. I think despite that, it's been wonderful to see the church step up and work together again around things like the Warm Welcome campaign and food banks, etc.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it was very beautiful to see, wasn't it? We actually, for the first time maybe ever, had a lot of mainstream reporting on how much work the church was doing, and it really sort of pushed the social action work that the church contributes to society into the public eye in a really positive way, which doesn't always happen. And like you said earlier, we need to really, really guard ourselves about creating some kind of messianic like feeling around that. But also, you know, it is really nice when the church can step into those gaps and say, do you know what, we can meet those needs, we can do what we believe God has asked us to do.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The one thing I would say, though, is that when we're doing that we shouldn't miss the opportunity to share the reason why. And the reason why is because Jesus loves us. And he loves the world too. And I think that shouldn't be lost. And that needs to be done in an appropriate way. You know, we should definitely not be doing social action with strings attached. But people who ask, what is motivating you to do this? What motivates a street passer to be on the street at 1 o'clock in the morning? People want to know, are you crazy? Why are you out here for free? I think those are moments where, in a very appropriate way, there is a conversation that can be opened up about why we do what we do.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really nice to hear you say that, because you often hear those two sides of the debate, don't you? People who are sort of very anchored to social action as the outworking of what the gospel tells us to do. And those people are like, no, we just need to tell people the gospel. Like, you know, this is the most important thing. Who cares whether they've got food? And we do have to sometimes work a little bit harder than I think we should have to bring those two together in a way that, like you say, just answers that question. Why are you doing this?
Yeah, I mean, the Bible says, go into all the world and preach the gospel, and I am with you always to the end of the earth. It also says in James 2, that don't have someone sitting in your midst and tell them to be warm and fed and not provide practically for their needs. We need the whole counsel of God. It's word and deed together. It will always be. And anyone who says anything else is actually not taking on board the whole counsel of God.
You've been in so many different positions of leadership in your career and you know, done some amazing things. Would you tell us some of the highlights and then perhaps some of the lowlights? What's the biggest challenge you faced as a leader, or the time that you've really had to wrestle with God for something, and what have been some of the real highlights where you've seen God do some really miraculous stuff?
I think the biggest challenge is for me generally in leadership, I would say that they've either involved people or money. Money, when money is short in charities, and anyone who's been in charitable work will know that there are moments, you know, where funds are short and you have to make difficult decisions. And in all the charities I've been in, there has been, to a larger or a lesser extent, an experience of that. And then, of course, people, you know, whether that be moral failure or just people in disagreement together and seeking to bring people together. Those are really tough moments in the life of any organisation. Mm. And I think that those have been, in my experience, the most challenging.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about moral failures for a moment, because that is never far from the public eye. That is such a massive problem for the church at the moment, and it is so heartbreaking. Mm. What would your advice be to someone who's really struggling through that? He's like, my faith is literally feels like it's falling apart right now because this particular leader is, I feel so heartbroken about what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember kind of during my pastoral life being in a church setting where I was not happy with the culture. And when I was leaving, I was one of the leaders who supported the calling of a meeting so that we could talk about the issues. And it was a very painful meeting. But I look back now on that, you know, nearly two decades ago, compared to what's going on today? And I said, well, I'm glad I did it, because we were able to address those issues there and then. And I could then leave that organisation feeling that, well, at least I've spoken out and I've named the issue. What's so sad about some of what we've recently seen is that this happened over many years, and it no one had the guts to call it out. It's always tough to call out abuse of any kind, but it's really important that we do it in an appropriate way. And we know with this stuff that it can come back to bite years and years later. And of course, over time, that damage just gets deeper and deeper.
So how do we guard our own faith against that? How do we sort of, you know, as Christians, just keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, I guess?
Yeah, I think accountability is really important. Genuine accountability, whereby we have systems and structures around us that can keep us in check. I think steering away from the cult of personality, I'm sad to say that there is too much cult of personality that I see generally in the church. And we do well much more to walk together in a healthy kind of respect for one another, but an openness, an accountability and a vulnerability that allows us to call out particular behaviour kind of when we see it. Too often that stuff gets left, it gets put up with, and in the end, it has a negative impact.
Celebrity culture within the Christian world is something that comes up quite regularly these days, isn't it? There was a piece of research recently that said most of the worship songs we sing in our Western churches come from four big mega churches in the States, of which you could probably name. Not that it's a secret, but you know, that sort of idea of how do we create a healthy culture in our churches, in our festivals, in our youth events, in our everything that doesn't put people on this pedestal, but that does, you know, necessarily allow those that God has gifted to teach and preach and speak and lead to do it well. But how do we do it well? How do we do it healthily?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that kind of leadership development needs to be built kind of into our seminaries, so that leadership formation is something that we are really focused on. But also I think that we need to create a much more reflective culture within leadership. So people are reflecting on their own leadership, but actually there's an opportunity for others to feedback to them on the impact of their leadership, whether that be positive or negative, and to do that in an honest way. And where that doesn't happen, and you end up on the slippery slope, and you end up with, you know, videos being posted from 10, 15 years ago, where clearly people were behaving in manners that were inappropriate, but no one said anything.
And do you have that in your life, Mike? Do you mind me asking, how do you manage it as a leader?
Yeah, no, very much I do. So I have leaders and friends. They will visit every now and then. I will spend time with them where I'm able to speak honestly, you know, about some of my challenges. But also I do spend a lot of time in personal reflection. Most mornings I will go for a walk and I will be reflecting on my ministry. And I'm really, really clear about the kind of leadership culture that I want to generate in any organisation that I lead. And and when I've seen something else, you know, internally within an organization, I've tried to challenge it. And you know, if you look after people will look after tasks. That's what I've always believed, and that's certainly kind of my mantra right now. We need to look after the people that we have entrusted to look after the various tasks of ministering kind of within a church or a parachurch setting.
And what is the culture that you're trying to sort of grow within Churches Together right now?
Yeah. So within my team, people first, that structures and systems kind of support people's ministry and the ministry of the church, and not the other way around. So that I think would be really important, and a very relational culture. And by that, I mean healthy relationships between church leaders of different denominations is really important. And the deepening of our relationships, the depth of our relationship, will really be the litmus test as to how far we can genuinely travel together.
Okay, just as we wrap up, I want to project us 10 years into the future. We're going to be heading towards 2033, we're getting older. What would your prayer be for the UK church? Or not even for the UK church, let's go bigger, let's go for the worldwide church. Yeah.
You know, I spend some time in Ghana, in West Africa. My wife is of Ghanaian heritage. So I do have a global as well as a church of Churches Together in England perspective, to see the church growing and making a genuine difference kind of in its local communities. I think when push comes to shove, it is about impact of on local people's lives. And, you know, wherever I see the church, whether it be in Pakistan, and I've been to Pakistan and seen the church there, whether it be in Ghana or whether it be here in the UK, the best of the church is seen when people open up the doors of the church, and I speak metaphorically as well as literally, and just embrace those who want to come in or who have needs that will be met as they engage. And for me, the more of that, the better.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family's schedule onto a sleek digital display, so you focus on important things, like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/talk.